Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, an hour to go, and it will go fast. Here's the number, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Brooke in San Jose, California. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Patrick. Glad to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I'll make it quick. I go to confession every Saturday, and I'm wondering if that's okay. I want to always be in a state of grace, and I do have sins, you know, that I accumulate through the week, and I go to the, you know, the priests all know me, and they kind of look at me like, you know, what's wrong with you? You're here again. And, I just wondered, am I misusing that sacrament? I mean, I truly did sin. And then I wonder, does everyone just go perfectly without sin, like for months on end without confessing, going to confession? So I just wondered if I should wait like every couple weeks, or if I should really go. If I've actually, because I do the examination of conscience, and I really want to be close to God, as close as I can be. That's my first question. And then my second question is,
You go to the second one, because by the time we talk about the first one, I will have forgotten the second one. So hold that in reserve.
Okay.
So let's talk a little bit about that. So, number one, confession is certainly necessary if you fall into serious sin. Now, it doesn't sound to me like that's the case with you. And you don't need to tell me. I'm not asking you to tell me that. But if you find yourself falling into mortal sin, then definitely go to confession as often as necessary. Going weekly, I think, is a beautiful thing. And if, when you're there, the priest sort of acts in an exasperated way toward you, the thing to remember, and, you know, he should know this, he should remember this too, is that confession is not merely for those who are in serious sin, but you can make a devotional confession when you're not in serious sin, and it's because of the graces that you receive from the sacrament. The power of Jesus Christ working in this sacrament has these beneficial replenishing effects on your souls. It strengthens you, it replenishes and intensifies grace. And this is all very good. So it's not necessary that one have a serious sin to avail himself of the sacrament of confession. And devotional confessions are really good. Now, here's why this is kind of a, you know, Catholicism 101, and I don't mean that for you, but let's just all think about this. The whole point of the Christian life is to outgrow that spiritual immaturity that leads to falling into mortal sin. And so those who are spiritually immature and weak and are not moving very far in the direction of perfection, they tend to fall into mortal sin a lot. You asked if people generally come to confession with pristine, pure souls. If I had to guess, I'd say probably not. Probably most people who are going to confession have serious sins on their soul. Now, that's not to judge anybody or to look down on anybody. It's just a fact, because we live in a world where it's very easy to fall into mortal sin. But here's the thing to remember. The whole point of the Christian life is to grow in maturity and to deepen your commitment to Jesus. And as soon as you can, as soon as God's grace enables you to never commit mortal sin again. So the sign of somebody who is growing in virtue and sanctity is she never falls into mortal sin. She just never commits a mortal sin. She wouldn't think of committing a mortal sin. That's a sign of Christian maturity. And that's what we're all called to. That's the whole point of the priest's ministry, sacramentally and preaching and the parochial duties and things. The whole point is to lead people into to those deeper waters so that they stop committing mortal sins. So that's why I've never understood exasperation on the part of a priest if Brooke from San Jose shows up every week and she doesn't have any serious sins and she's, you know, confessing her predominant faults and whatever things might be going on at a venial level. You should, priest, you should rejoice at that. You should, you know, give a spiritual high five. This is great, because that means that what you're doing as a priest is having an effect. So let's never lose sight of that fact. The goal is to stop committing mortal sins entirely and move forward in that regard. So that's my advice, Brooke. Keep doing what you're doing. Now, as a little practical matter, it may be that perhaps Father McGillicuddy is exasperated because there are 30 people in line behind you, and he's got a lot of people who do have mortal sins, and if they don't go to confession, they're not going to be able to receive communion, or they're going on a trip, and they're, you know, that I don't want to die in mortal sin kind of thing. So I can understand if Father McGillicuddy might, without, you know, really thinking it through, he might look at you as a speed bump. But one way you can handle that is you could just maybe get there early and be the first one in line, or you can keep your confessions very brief, not ask for spiritual direction. It's a good idea to do in any case. You're not there for spiritual direction per se. If he wants to give it to you, that's great. But otherwise, just confess your sins, number and kind, be done with it, and off you go. And I think priests do appreciate that if it's a devotional confession and they realize that you realize that there are 10 people in line behind you, so you're being sensitive to them. Those are practical little ways that you can show consideration to others. Now, lastly, Brooke, if you find that in your parish, for whatever reason, the parish priest gives you the impression that he's irritated by you going, just go find a priest who's not going to do that. Find a good spiritual director or what have you, and you can avoid that problem. Now, you said you had a second question. I hope that first part helps.
It does. And I do have a hard time with using the Lord's name in vain. So every time I do, I write down how many times I do it a week. And it's reduced greatly. But anything that I think that I'm going to offend God with, I'm there at 3:30 praying the rosary and waiting. I'm usually the first in line for confession. And I feel great. You know,
well, that's good. I'd like to interrupt, if I may, and just say this is an important thing you're bringing up, because that is a sin of blasphemy. And blasphemy is a serious sin. Now, you may be an inveterate blasphemer because you grew up that way or whatever, and it may be second nature, and you're not thinking about it when you utter the blasphemy. It's still a serious sin, though, even though your own personal culpability might be somewhat diminished by that. But that's the kind of thing that if I were you, I mean, speaking as your brother in Christ, I would say attack that sin mercilessly. Attack it ruthlessly and never allow a blasphemy to come out of your mouth ever again. And you may say, I know it's hard, but you can do it. So I would go to war against that sin and never let it happen. That'd be my advice.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you. And I'll move quickly to my other question.
Sure.
I have a lot of things going on in with my children. I think I've told you before. And I'm a single mom and living in poverty, and my kids have a lot of psychological issues. So I'm struggling, and I do have like a weight problem. It's embarrassing. And I do eat out of comfort or feeling
stressed.
Mm-hmm. And that's gluttony. And that's what if I were to die, you know, in a car accident? And I'm just saying it, that's a mortal sin, and I should talk to the priest about that. And I want to get healthy. So
let's look at that. Okay. Because here's an interesting thing. And I hope this gives you a little bit of consolation here. Gluttony is one of the capital sins, along with lust and avarice and wrath and pride, etc. So gluttony is one of those capital sins. Interestingly, though, if you look at St. Thomas Aquinas' treatise on the virtues, when he discusses the vice of gluttony, he says it can often not be a mortal sin. And it depends upon your state in life, and obviously in your circumstances, you've got added stresses and strains. And, you know, let's face it, food is one of those comforting things that even if it's not good for you to have the food, it makes you feel better in the moment. So my thought here would be, if you want to read St. Thomas's discussion of gluttony, then that's online. It's in English. I'll find it, and we'll post a link to it on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. But do read it. And I would just simply say this. Remember when you're reaching for the food, when you open that refrigerator door, say these words to yourself. God is not in the refrigerator. God is not in the pantry. God is not in the can of beer or the box of wine or what have you. It's not that you can't drink wine or have beer or eat food or what have you. But when you realize that ultimately your bodily craving is seeking a satisfaction that can't be completely fulfilled with food or drink or television or whatever, it's actually God and your desire for God that you're experiencing. And that's a beautiful thing when you think about it. And so one of the helps, like some people when they're trying to quit smoking, they have a rubber band on their wrist and they snap it just to give like a little pain sensation when they feel the cravings for a cigarette. For some people, that's helpful. So maybe try that. Just when you're going to get the food, just say, God is not in the refrigerator. I'm looking for God, something that only God can satisfy, and it's not going to be found in the refrigerator or the pantry. As far as the gluttony issue itself is concerned, since you're aware of it and you realize that this is impacting your health and so on, ask the Lord for the graces that you need to be able to overcome this fault. We all have our faults, and I'd say gluttony is a pretty widespread fault. Look at us as a society. We're a lot fatter now than people were 50 years ago. That's true. Maybe it has a lot to do with processed foods and things. I don't know. But I also think we have to practice more self-control. Well, we all do. And I'll be at the front of the line for that myself. But knowing this is half the battle. You're aware of it, and you want to overcome it. The way to overcome vices like gluttony or lust or wrath or avarice or whatever is to practice the opposing virtue. And in this case, the opposing virtue is moderation. So to begin the process of saying no to the second helping or saying no to little things. And here's something, and I don't want to belabor the point, Brooke, but maybe this is helpful. A few days ago, yesterday, whenever, I talked about custody of the eyes. I don't know if you heard that part of the show when I was talking about how to avoid lust by practicing custody of the eyes. Did you hear that part?
I did not, unfortunately. I listened to the first part in the morning when I was getting my kids for school, but I did not hear that part.
Okay, well, I'll just give a quick synopsis just for the sake of it. So this is something anyone can do, and especially if you have difficulty, and I don't mean you personally, but whoever has difficulty with lustful thoughts, etc., this is a technique that really works. So you practice custody of the eyes in little things where it could be a billboard, could be oncoming traffic, could be a tree, could be whatever. Your natural curiosity in looking around, you're looking at all kinds of things all the time. So the technique is simply training yourself to say, no, I'm not going to look at that tree. I'm not going to look at that billboard. I'm not going to look at that bicycle, what have you. Now, there's nothing in itself that's problematic about any of those things. There's no reason why you couldn't look at it. And if you did look at it, it doesn't cause you any harm one way or the other. But what this does is it trains your will to say no. It's like taking the stairs instead of the escalator. You could take the escalator, but you take the stairs instead. There's more aerobic activity, etc. What happens is when you practice custody of the eyes, over time, not only are you able to do this because it becomes a stable disposition within you, it becomes a kind of virtue within you where you have mastery over something simple like your eyesight and your curiosity. Then what happens is when those big temptations show up, as they inevitably do, then you will be able to say, no, I'm not going to look at that. I'm not going to look at him. I'm not going to look at her. I'm not going to look at that. And you will be able to do that. So what happens is you're cultivating this virtue through the practice of custody of the eyes that enables you. So your default becomes self-control. Now, the same technique can be applied in the case of food or drink, for that matter. In other words, practicing moderation. And usually it seems to me that moderation is a more effective way of doing it than trying to cut it off cold turkey. You could do that. Some people can, most people can't, but you can practice moderation so that little by little you build up this sense of mastery over your appetite to say no to the second helping or no to the, you know, the double whopper with extra cheese and bacon and, you know, the stuff you know is going to ultimately harm your waistline. And the more you do that, the more you build up to it, the easier it becomes. And then what you'll notice is that vice begins to wither and die, because it's being replaced by the virtue that you're cultivating. So thank you for listening to my long-winded answer. A lot of this is detailed in a book called An Introduction to the Devout Life by St. Francis de Sales. That'd be a good book if you want to have a companion to kind of take with you. But I'm really glad we talked today, Brooke. I'm glad you called me, and I'm hopeful that some of these things will be helpful to you. Thank you. Quick time out, and we'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. How are you aligning your financial plan with your Catholic values? Is your Catholic faith influencing your financial future? Our sponsor, Creative Planning, has options. More info, including disclosures, at creativeplanning.com/Catholic Focus.
Patrick Madrid is on Coast to Coast on Relevant Radio.
I like this radio program. I like this song. I like my job.
Then maybe you should stop singing.
Yeah, really. Well, there's no danger that I'm going to win on America's Got Talent anytime soon. Unless they have a radio contest, maybe I could win there. 888-914-9149. Bob in Highland, Indiana. Good morning. How high is Highland? Morning. It can't be very high.
No, it's actually kind of low, but they call it Highland.
Yeah, gotcha.
So, yeah. Patrick, first, I'm honored to talk to you, but I retired a couple years ago, and I started going to daily mass and confession and all that. I've always wanted to do that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've noticed that I'm out of sync or something. At least something's changed. I didn't get the memo when they changed it, I guess, but... when we kneel in the during the liturgy of the Eucharist, after the holy, 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 everybody kneels, and that's the way I've always, every church I've ever gone to does. And then when it gets into the consecration, and at some point, it seems to me, they interrupt the consecration to do, and we stand up, and then they do the Lord's Prayer, and a sign of peace. And a sign of peace, I don't even participate in that, and I don't know if that's wrong or right. But I don't like it. To me, it's kind of offensive just because of where it's at. It's right in the middle of the consecration. But anyway, then they keep standing, and then we do the Lamb of God, and I kneel there. And that, it seems like all my life since I was a child, I was going to Mass in the 50s when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And Catholic school, we always knelt. And after communion, I come back, and I kneel. And the priest even had a little memo from the bishop a couple of weeks ago, politely done. But basically, I think they want you to stand. Everybody stands. And I find that offensive, frankly, that everybody's standing. But I kneel. And there's a few other people. It's just a handful older people. We kneel. And then everybody's supposed to kneel when he's after communion's done. And he tells everybody they can either kneel or sit. Mm-hmm. And then I kneel until he he says, it's time to get up, you know. And anyway, I just wanted to bounce that off of you. And if that's wrong, being out of sync with everybody else, because I know it's the public prayer, but it just seems to me like it's disrespectful, outlandishly disrespectful.
Yeah. Now, was there a gap in time where you weren't going to Mass from the time you were younger?
No.
You've always gone to Mass, right?
I always go to Mass. And in fact, I'd like to go. I'm trying to get back to the Latin Mass. It's still offered. So,
yeah, that's good.
But, yeah.
Okay, so here are some thoughts. Number one, the bishops of the United States this goes back quite a long time. They established that in this country, the norm is that at certain points of the Mass that the faithful kneel. And what you're remembering is during the traditional Latin Mass, before the Lamb of God, the Agnus Dei, before that was said, the people would kneel, and then the priest would turn to the congregation, and he would hold up the consecrated host and say, Ecce Agnus Dei, so behold the Lamb of God, behold him who takes away the sins of the world. So the posture in the traditional Mass was to kneel at that time. Now, in the new rite of the Mass, the posture is to say the Lamb of God and then kneel. And that's, since the time of the Council, that's been the approved posture and that time for kneeling. And then in the same way, the faithful are to kneel during the Eucharistic prayer. And then when you get to, in Latin, it's the per ipsum. In English, through him, with him, in him, you know, when the priest raises the chalice and the paten with the consecrated host, and he says, through him, with him, and in him. At that point, after that is said, then everybody stands, and we recite the Our Father, and then shortly after that, we kneel again when it comes to the Sanctus, the Holy, Holy, Holy. So one thing that's happening here, Bob, seems to me, is that you're remembering when it was customary to kneel in the traditional Mass, and it's slightly different in the new Mass. And so my advice would be, well, let me get to the second part, then this will make more sense. The other thing that it sounds like you're experiencing is that there's some tampering with the rubrics of the Mass, maybe on the part of the priest, maybe on the part of whatever, whoever, where they have, in a misguided way, they have gone along with some, I would say, you know, really faulty sacramental theology, really faulty liturgical theology that found its origin in the United States, primarily in Southern California, where decades ago the people were told, you're no longer allowed to kneel during the Eucharistic prayer, you have to stand. You're no longer allowed to kneel when you come back from receiving Holy Communion, you have to stand. You're no longer allowed to kneel during the Holy, Holy, Holy. You have to stand. And so that was enforced upon the people. I think it was terribly misguided, and unfortunately it persists to this day. I would like to see it reversed. But it's completely out of sync with the norms that were given by the U.S. bishops as to when the faithful are supposed to stand and kneel during the Mass. And it is an engine of disunity, this aberration that was introduced and has been picked up here and there, but thankfully not very widespread. It introduces disunity because now you have people who are standing when everybody else in the country is kneeling. And you can't help but say, well, why aren't you kneeling? Are you afraid to show respect to Jesus? And most of the people, it's like, no, we were told we have to do this. And over time, it became an ingrained habit, and that's what they do now. And so it's just a mess, if you ask me. And I wish that those pastoral changes had never been introduced because they have been nothing but problematic theologically, in terms of piety and in other ways. That's my strong opinion on the issue. Suffice to say that it may be at the parish that you're at that this is part of what's going on here. So they're not even doing it in accordance with, it may be the case that they're not doing it in accordance with what the bishops have said. This is when everybody's supposed to kneel. So since you find this aggravating and it's, how did you say, it's offensive, my advice would be go to a different parish. Because chances are this is not something that's widespread. It's, in my experience, traveling the country for 35, 36, 37 years, going all around the country, parishes big and small, in towns and cities and in the middle of nowhere, I'm happy to report that most Catholic parishes, most everywhere, they adhere to the proper posture during Mass. Here and there, you find places where they've gone off the rails and they don't do that. So I wouldn't be surprised, Bob, if there were any number of parishes within a reasonable driving distance where you could go to Mass and not be bothered by these things. That's my practical advice.
Okay. I did go to a different parish. It's kind of far away, but they didn't do it this way. And my son and daughter-in-law go to this church, and I moved, so it's only blocks away, so it's convenient.
Yeah, that's what I'd suggest. It sounds like that's an easy fix. The pendulum swung very far in the wrong direction during the 70s, especially in the 80s. I was a witness to it, and I saw some of the insanity that passed for liturgical rubrics and things. And I'm glad that the pendulum has been swinging back in the right direction. It's still got a ways to go, but most Catholic parishes have recovered from the excesses and exaggerations and aberrations that took place in the 80s especially. And maybe we'll just have to wait it out. So I hope that's helpful, Bob. Thank you. Let's go now to, where are we going? Let's go to Caroline in Whittier, California. Hi, Caroline.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a grown nephew who has a 7-year-old son, and he has made it clear that he will allow that child to pick his own religion later in life. My nephew went to Catholic schools for all of his education, and I really would like to be able to address him on the subject. I'd like to address him well, because I find it difficult.
Sure. I can understand why. Because you love that child and you love the 7-year-old, your great nephew, and you want to see him happy. Well, I may not be the right guy to give you what you're looking for, because you're probably looking for something tactful and nuanced and effective in getting somebody to say, oh, okay. I take a different approach to this, Caroline. In my view, and I would say this to to him if I were at a dinner party and he was telling me this, I would say that's foolish and lazy. What?
Yes.
You heard me.
Yes.
That's foolish and lazy. First of all, you're a fool if you think, and yes, I know Jesus said don't call people fools. I think there's a nuance there, but we don't have to get into it. It's foolish to say, I'm going to let my kid grow up and then decide what religion he wants to be. By then, it's too late to lock the barn door because the horses are gone. You're setting him up for failure. So it's foolish to assume that without proper guidance and teaching him the truth, that he's suddenly going to have this miraculous epiphany and realize, oh, I need to be Catholic. I mean, I suppose it could happen, but the likelihood is very small. So it's foolish. It's also foolish because it gets to the question of, is your nephew, is he a believer? If he's a believer, if he's a follower of Jesus, then the whole point of following Jesus is to raise up his own family, if he has children, to be followers of Jesus, to believe the gospel, to desire to be happy with God in heaven. And so it's the height of foolishness to say, well, I'm going to leave that to a child to decide when he gets older. Now, the second thing is, it's lazy, because there's no good reason to do this other than, and this is not a good reason, but what it really means is he doesn't want to be bothered living the faith, because if he's going to raise his son in the faith, if he's going to raise his son as a follower of Jesus, if he's going to raise his son to follow and believe the gospel, that means he has to do it too, and he doesn't want to do it. That's what's really going on here. He doesn't want to do it. I can guarantee, Caroline, back me up on this one. I don't know him, but I can guarantee that he probably doesn't go to Mass himself, does he?
He is a good man, but he does not practice the faith.
See, there it is. So this is a blatant form of laziness. Because you, and it sounds nice, it looks good on paper, I guess to some people, it doesn't look good to me, to say, well, I'm going to allow my child to decide when he's old enough. All it really means is I don't want to be bothered doing the things that I don't want to be bothered doing, like going to Mass and praying and all that God stuff. So I'm going to put this label on my laziness to make it look as though I am really a noble, free-thinking guy, because I'm going to allow my child to have the freedom to blah, 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 blah. It's just sheer laziness. So honestly, Caroline, probably would not be a good idea for me to hang out with your nephew anytime soon, because if this came up, that's exactly what I would tell him.
And he probably would not want
to have a cup of coffee with me after that. But that's the honest truth. And I would say it the way a doctor might say, here's why you have that pain in your abdomen. This is what's going on. He may not like to hear it, but that's my take on it.
I agree. And I feel comfortable enough to say that you've got to walk the walk and talk the talk, and you're not willing to do it.
Yeah.
That's the problem. And it's not right and it's not fair. You have emboldened me.
I'm glad. I'm glad. Maybe if enough of us were bold enough to just tell it like it is, this would start to not be so much of a problem.
Well, I appreciate your honesty, and I love the child. I love his father, and I feel compelled to go forward.
Yeah.
as necessary.
God bless you. God bless you. And may God give you the words to say and the way in which to say it that will get through to him.
Yes. Well, he's given me the backbone, so we're good.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Caroline.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome. Yeah. You know, we live in a culture, don't we, where people are afraid of confrontation. I don't like confrontation. I would much rather not have confrontation in my life, believe me. But ultimately, you have to take a stand at times, and that necessarily involves confrontation. Jesus talked about it. He says, I have not come to bring peace, but division. And he talks about how in families of father against his son and a mother against her daughter and a mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law. So even within family units, it's not that Jesus is prescribing division. He's not prescribing it. He's describing it. He's saying, if you're my follower, if you really believe what I'm telling you, and I'm telling you the truth, and if you believe me, and you're going to pick up your cross and follow me, if you're going to be my disciple, then get ready for division, because there will be people even in your own family who are not going to go along with that. It's something up with which they will not put.
I'm a reasonable guy, but I've just experienced some very unreasonable things.
Yeah, you get it. Let's go to Laura now in Austin, Texas. Hi, Laura.
Hey, Patrick. Hey, so I'm a mom of two boys. Put them through
Congratulations.
Catholic school. One, yes, and they're the best. So they both have gone through Catholic school. One is seventh grader, and one is getting ready to graduate.
Okay.
And with my experience of them going through Catholic school and coming out on the other side, they both have really great faith. But what I've seen and experienced in Catholic schools, and ours is an independent Catholic school.
Okay.
So is that, you know, of course, we welcome everyone of all faith or no faith. But for some reason, a lot of people that surrounded my son were atheists or agnostics or and really well versed in their non-belief. Okay. And their anti-Catholic stuff. And so it
and these were students or these were teachers, God forbid?
Students, yeah.
Okay.
Students. And we have had some teachers come in and try to push different agendas, but thankfully okay. They're gone. But there,
so you're
always
concerned about your kids, your sons being swayed by the atheist students?
No, I'm not at all about that, because I think challenging your faith is a good thing. But the reason I bring this up is because I think in our Catholic schools, we don't teach apologetics. And you were talking about it earlier today, but this has been on my mind, and I've talked to all of theology departments, the heads of schools, and the board of directors there as well, just about how, you know, we're not really equipping our kids to leave and go off to college with a defense of our faith. You know, like I said, yeah. The other side is very well versed and can like overwhelm kids mm-hmm. with their disbelief. And
so just because there's a break right around the corner, could you maybe uh-huh. put it in the form of a question maybe? Because I want to make sure I don't miss.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I was wondering if you had any recommendations for curriculum that I can suggest to the schools. And I really want to do it for all of Austin Catholic schools as well.
I do.
Because I think apologetics is so important. Okay, great.
I do. So do you have a pen handy? I'm going to give you several recommendations.
I do.
Okay.
Okay.
Number one, listen to relevant radio. And I'm not being glib. Have encourage the kids or the teachers to include relevant radio. This program would be serviceable. So maybe they could, one assignment for them is they have to listen an hour a week to the Patrick Madrid show and get a dose okay. of apologetics. And then, you know, maybe there's an assignment. You have to write a, you know, 100-word explanation of something you heard on relevant. It could be simple like that.
Okay, great.
Okay, so then I would recommend that they get a, now you say these are high schoolers or junior high
school? Well, I want to start in middle school and then high school as well.
Okay. So in that case, what I would do is I would recommend a book that I myself wrote. It's called How to Do Apologetics. And it's a book that will give the students an overview. First of all, what does it mean to do apologetics? Or what are you doing? You're explaining and defending your faith. Well, how do you do that? How do you avoid logical fallacies? How do you spot logical fallacies in things that other people might say? How do you handle evidence? What kinds of evidence are there? What about inductive logic and deductive logic and all kinds of things that we use without necessarily thinking about them? But in the book, How to Do Apologetics, I basically give you the architecture of what all this is and how things fit together and how you can do apologetics. So that's the book, How to Do Apologetics. Then if they read that, then I would say the course or the curriculum would be the Beginning Apologetics Workbooks by Jim Burnham and Father Frank Chacon. And these are individual workbooks, 8.5 by 11 size. They're about 30, 35 pages. So they're not books, but each one of these volumes, and there may be 12 or 15 of them, each one is on a specific topic. So apologetics on how to deal with atheists is one booklet. There's another one on the Eucharist, another one on Mary, another one on the divinity of Jesus. There's another one on the papacy. There's another one on, you know what I'm saying? So each one of these is a discrete topic. And what you could do is if the class got the set, then you could begin with the first volume, which is basically how to do apologetics at a general level. And then you proceed in a systematic way into each of these other areas. So how do you demonstrate the reasonableness of believing in God and so on? That would be a ready-made, easy-to-follow, very accessible curriculum for any middle schooler or high schooler. That would be really effective, easy to follow. Now, there is a higher-level book. I'll leave you with this last one. Actually, I'm going to give you two more recommendations. Then I have to take a break. One is called Handbook of Catholic Apologetics by Peter Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T, and Father Ron Ticelli. It's for high schoolers and up, but it's very good, very comprehensive. So once these kids have been through the Beginning Apologetics curriculum, then they would be ready to graduate to this book. And then lastly, I want to recommend the Aquinas 101 videos that are available on YouTube. They're free. Each one's about 7-8 minutes long, and they're produced by the Dominican friars of the Eastern Province, the St. Joseph Province. So these are Dominicans, and they take specific topics. How do I know God exists? The sacraments, grace and free will, all the component parts of our faith, and they have individual videos about that thing. So you have the friar who's giving the explanation, and there's graphics, and it's easy to follow. It's good, and it's very deep, but it's accessible even for younger people like these people. Those are all free. So get those. And even if it's just your own sons, get them on a steady diet of that stuff, and they'll be better for it. Thank you. Man, did I go over the time, but hey, it's my show. I'm coming right back right after this.
If you're in the market for health insurance, our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is here to help you and your family find the most cost-effective plan. Learn more at relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, let's do this thing. Let's go to Francisco in Rancho Santa Margarita. Good morning, Francisco.
Hey, good morning. Am I on?
You are on, officially.
This is cool, officially. All right, so I've got a request, and then I've got a question, if that's okay.
All right, go for it.
All right, so request. A couple of years ago, my wife told me, hey, don't forget to pay the babysitter, and by the way, get Patrick Madrid's autograph. And I didn't know what the heck she was talking about.
All in the same breath? She said that all in one sentence?
All in one sentence. And, I was coming back from a work trip, and apparently you were the dad picking up your daughter. And so I didn't put two and two together.
Oh.
So I'm going to, she printed out one of the articles you wrote for you to sign. And obviously I didn't know what the heck was going on. So I'm going to send you a copy of that article, and hopefully you can sign and send it back in time for Mother's Day. So that's a request. I thought that was like a smart
that's
way of getting
that done. I can comply with that, but I'm mystified now because all of my children are adults. So this must have been a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, this was probably 6 or 7 years ago. Long
time. Oh, well, my kids are all adults. My oldest kids are in their 40s. So
really? Maybe it was a grandchild.
That sounds more like it. Yeah.
Maybe it was grandchild, yeah.
Where was this? This was in California?
Rancho Santa Margarita, OC, yeah.
Yeah, I'm there's something that's not quite right here. I don't know what it is. I grew up real close to there. I mean, I grew up in Mission Viejo, so I wasn't too far away from there. But
there you go. Or maybe you're picking someone up, or anyway, I got in a lot of trouble for that. You know, where's his autograph? And I was very mystified as well.
Oh,
but we'll
boy.
Get it done. In the event, we'll get it done.
All right. Well, here's one thing that I had a grandson who visited my sister who lives in that area. She lives real close to Rancho Santa Margarita.
Maybe that's
what it was. It was a grandson.
That was probably it. Yeah.
All right. Well, send me that article. I will be happy to autograph it for your lovely wife.
Thank you. And so here's the question, right? So we are the godparents to my wife's daughter. And this is more broadly. Well, I'll get
to
more broadly.
Godparents to your wife's daughter?
Sorry. My wife's sister's daughter.
Niece. Okay. Your niece.
Yep.
Okay. Got it.
Yep. And so, so baptized, I don't know, probably 5-6 years ago. She's 7 or 8 now. And then, you know, I mentioned to my wife, hey, you know, when's her Holy Communion? Why haven't, you know, let's keep tabs, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a revert, so maybe I just missed the memo on what a godparent's supposed to do. And then so she said, yeah, you're right. And we always assumed that they were masculine Catholics because, for Christmas they would come to Mass with us and Easter.
Yeah.
And then, we had a conversation a couple months ago, and the sister says, and, you know, what reminded me of this was the conversation you were just having with the other caller about, I think, her nephew, right, and being lazy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what prompted me to call in, and the sister says, well, you know, and her husband's not Catholic. He's evangelical or something. And then the sister says, well, you know, I'm not really sure whether we buy into this. Like, why do you have to do First Communion? you know, and you go down the rabbit hole. And, you know, there's no point in creating tension, right? There's no point in saying, well, you know, hey, no, you're Catholic and your daughter's a baptized Catholic and she needs to go to First Communion. That's
I think there's a point to doing that.
Yeah. Handled in the right way. Yeah. Yes. And there's some family dynamics that make it kind of tough. But, you know, if it were, put it this way, if it were my sibling, I would have the direct conversation, right? You know, hey, so-and-so, you signed me up for this. You know, we're going to get this child catechized. So I guess, you know, on one level, the question is just on a personal level, right? What's your advice? You know, what should I tell my wife? What should I be thinking about doing? And then just more broadly, you know, what are the responsibilities? Yep.
Are she and her, is your wife and your sister-in-law, are they close?
Yeah, they're platonically close.
Well, so, that's what I mean.
You know, they'll hang out. Yeah.
But what I mean is they have a good relationship. They interact. They communicate well. Okay. They like each other. Okay.
They like each other, but they don't have the deep conversations. Like, this would be a very unnatural conversation to have.
Okay. But they're standing. In other words, the as sisters and as friends, they, you know, they know each other well enough. They like each other well enough that it, at least they're standing.
Yep.
Yeah, so I would say just be forthright. If you don't think you're the one to deliver that message, and maybe you're not under the circumstances, but your wife certainly could. And I think it's entirely reasonable. In fact, I would say there's a certain obligation that's built in here because of the family relationship, and it's all the more so because you and your wife agreed to be godparents, and you undertook to help raise this child in the faith, if there was any need for that, and apparently there is. So your wife has every reason to say, you know, hey, can we go get a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and sit down and talk about this? And she can make the case to her sister, you know, you for your sake of your child, you really need to follow through on the promises that you made when you had this baby baptized. You made certain promises to God and to the church about raising your child in the faith. And I made some promises too, as did Francisco. We both promised that we would help in doing this. And so that's the reason why I'm having this conversation with you, is because I want to help. I want to help you do this. And if she says, well, we don't really buy into that stuff anymore, then what I would do if I were your wife, and you too, would be to say, well, then let us help with that. Let's find out. I mean, before you walk away or drift away from this Catholic faith that you're not sure you buy into, really, why don't you find out, her I'm talking about, you know, what it really is? Don't walk away from something if you don't know what it really is. You know, we'd like to share with you and study with you. There are great books. Listening to Relevant Radio can certainly help. There's an organization called Lighthouse Catholic Media, and they've got many different talks by Catholic speakers on specific topics that could be very helpful in reinvigorating their faith. Maybe if you live close enough, you can invite them to start going back to Mass with you. There are a lot of things you can do creatively, send them books, many, many different things. But I would say throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. But it's that personal effort on the part of your wife and you that I think can really help.
Yeah, no, that's great. And then as godparents, this is more broadly speaking, right? I mean, not to get too legalistic, but what's my, I don't know, responsibility or culpability or whatever? Because, you know, we signed the piece of paper. It's got to mean something, right?
It does, yeah. So you're not culpable for anything, I mean, thus far as I know. If you were to just say, well, I wash my hands of this, it's too difficult and I don't want a confrontation, I'm not going to bother. Yeah, you'd be culpable because you made a promise to God and to the parents and to the child and the church that you were going to do what you can. Now, that's the key. You can only do what you can do as a godfather and your wife as a godmother. You can't, and God doesn't hold you accountable for something that's beyond your control. So you make an honest effort, you make a good faith effort, try to be persistent, try to be persuasive. If the door is slammed in your face, you're not culpable. You're doing what you can do. But of course, in the middle of all this, you can be praying for this child and praying for the parents. So you have a lot of proactive tools at your disposal, even if they're not directly working on that family. But I would just keep doing what you're doing. It sounds like you and your wife are good godparents, and just keep doing it and be gentle and ask the Lord to help you help them. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if in due time there's a miracle of conversion that takes place with the parents. But keep at it. Don't give up. Be gentle, be polite, but don't be timid. You know, don't be afraid to speak up. Well, maybe call me in 6 months, Francisco, and let me know how that goes. I'd love to know. Thank you. Let's go to Adele now. Adela, excuse me, in Mission Hills, California. We have to be quick, Adela, but welcome.
It'll be quick, Patrick. My question is about the Eucharist and receiving it. I had went to confession. I would say maybe it was during the COVID, and I was told by the priest in my church that I wasn't able to receive the Eucharist because my husband and I were not married in the Catholic Church.
Okay. So now, you were divorced and then remarried?
No. I've only been married to him. He's the only one. I was not married in the Catholic Church.
Got it. And you yourself are a Catholic, but you weren't married in the Catholic Church, right?
Yes. Both my husband and I were both Catholics.
Okay.
But we were rejected. I was 17. He was 19.
I have an answer for you. I can help you. Okay. Just given the information that you've given me, there are two things that you can do. Number one, in the meantime, you can live with your husband as brother and sister until you get your marriage convalidated. That's the second thing you can do. The church can, as the saying goes, bless your marriage. So if, let's say, the priest says, well, we can't do that for a month, then wait a month and live as brother and sister with your husband. Make a good confession. Be in the state of grace. And yes, you can receive Holy Communion. Those are the two obstacles that lie in the way, but you can overcome that.